Preventing banning mask mandates, I should say, preventing local officials from taking actions that could protect their populations. And now we're clearly seeing the result. You know, he attended a large Republican fundraiser. I'm not sure if that's where he contracted it, but at some point he contracted it. I highly doubt he's come in contact with any of the migrants
who
recently
arrived
in the United States.
Well, I want to thank you very much.
Very concerning hearing this rhetoric from him.
Manoj Govindaya, Director of Policy and Government Affairs at Raicis in Texas. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gozder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkaff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Adriana Contreras, our General Manager, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, I'm Andrew Geller, host of Unbroken Chain, Music of the Grateful Dead and Friends, noon to 2, the third Saturday of every month. Throughout August, we're bringing you special episodes of our program to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the show. And KBOO is raising money for a new Studio Transmitter Link, or STL, to bring sound to listeners. Tune in Saturdays, noon to 2, and text GDAF to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/grateful to contribute to this one-time campaign. Thank you for your support for Grateful Dead and Friends and KBOO Community Radio.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8:01. It's Wednesday. Stay tuned for the Wednesday Talk Radio program with your host, Paul Roland. Coming up next.
You're slick, you investors in hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you're a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done. War after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. You twisters of language, you creeps of disguise, yeah, disinformation. like worms in your eyes. You privileged bankers, you gambler thieves. You profit on war. You think it's just less money in peace. So that's how it's done. Time after time, country after country, and crime after crime. You pretend it's religion, like there's no one to blame for the dead and impoverished in your little patriot game. Honey, that's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. You got the world's greatest power, and you team up with thugs, make a fortune on weapons, destruction and drugs. But your flags and boots and uniforms, they start to all smell the same when all sides are killing in the patriot game. And that's how it's done. And you've got our sons in the crosshairs of horror at the end of your guns. And your national anthems, they start to all smell like shame when all sides are dying in the patriot game. It's just a war racket. That's just a war racket. It's just a war racket. It's just a war racket. And war is never, never holy. It's just a greedy man's dream. And you two-faced crusaders, both sides are obscene. War is not made by God. War is just made by men who misdirect our attention while you thieves do your thing. And that's how it's done. About every 30 years, the rich fill their coffers, the poor fill with tears, the young fill the coffins, the old hang a wreath, the politicians get photographed with their names underneath. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. That's the war racket. It's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket.
Yeah, you tell it like it is, Buffy St. Marie, the war racket. All these charlatans and hypocrites being either sanctimonious or accusatory, depending on a lot on which side of the aisle, but, you know, not uniformly, but, you know, as if, sure, there's mistakes being made and the same stupid mistakes repeated over and over again. Of course, that just goes without saying with a corrupt political class that we've got. But, you know, I mean, the Republicans laying so much on Biden. You know, I mean, how do you tease it all out when you've got 20 years of numbing tragedy and hypocrisy and profiteering at the root of it? The Raytheons and the General Dynamics and the all the usual players made off with billions, and all the new contractors making their bundle off of the war racket. And now everybody's pointing fingers and trying to figure it all out when, you know, it was just a crime from the very beginning, as we know. So that's one thing is on my mind. Unfortunately, there's something up with the computer here where I am at KBOO Production One. I can't get into it. I had a few articles I wanted to cite. So it looks like I'm not going to be able to do that. But the number here is 503-231-8187 to call in and get your views on the air. I am Paul Rowland. I guess I didn't introduce myself at the start. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. This is a live call-in program with hopefully lots of listener participation. There's so much going on and, you know, don't get too many chances to voice your ideas, opinions in public. This is one opportunity you've got here right in locally in Portland, Oregon, or wherever you're listening at, you can still call in at 503-231-8187. Some of the things I want to talk about, continue to talk about the climate disaster that is unfolding on our upon our skins before our eyes, creating disaster upon disaster, and how it's linked with war, how war has been really the main driver of all the industrial processes, all the expansions, everything that's created the modern world, which is steeped in the terrible injustices and genocides and wars of colonialism, which basically set the stage for the global colonization, global industrialization that has led to where we are right now. So, yeah, Afghanistan, Iraq, we certainly created a nice, stable, democratic nation state in our image, which, of course, was the illusion that the powers that be were trying to portray to justify their continued colonization of that country. And seemingly made it worse. In fact, strengthened the hand of the Taliban. Anyway, I've also got a book I've been reading, fascinating book, which is really kind of turning my head around. The Most Dangerous Animal: Human Nature and the Origins of War, by David Livingston Smith. Brilliant book. Let me just read from the back cover here. About almost 200 million human beings, mostly civilians, have died in wars over the last century, and there's no end to slaughter in sight. The Most Dangerous Animal asks what it is about human nature that makes it possible for human beings to regularly slaughter their own kind. It tells the story of why all human beings have the potential to be hideously cruel and destructive to one another. Why are we our own worst enemy? This book shows that war has been with us in one form or another since prehistoric times, and looking at the behavior of our close relatives, the chimpanzees, it argues that a penchant for group violence has been bred into us over millions of years of biological evolution. The Most Dangerous Animal takes the reader on a journey through evolution, history, anthropology, and psychology, showing how and why the human mind has a dual nature. On the one hand, we are ferocious, dangerous animals who regularly commit terrible atrocities against our own kind. On the other, we have a deep aversion to killing, a horror of taking human life. Meticulously researched and far-reaching in scope, and with examples taken from ancient and modern history, The Most Dangerous Animal delivers a sobering lesson for an increasingly dangerous world. And David Livingston Smith is a professor of philosophy and co-founder and director of the Institute for Cognitive Science and Evolutionary Psychology at the University of New England. So anyway, this book actually kind of goes against a lot of tacit, even explicit assumptions that I have held, and I'm about halfway through it, so I can't say that I am fully convinced of his argument, but it is challenging because, yeah, I've basically kind of bought into the idea that, we became warlike with civilization, and that, you know, the whole institution of private property, the institution of hierarchy and patriarchy, you know, sort of the need to have a armed forces to guard the granary and to, you know, expand if once. Certain groups like overtook their own ability to feed themselves, et cetera. But I'm willing to entertain new ideas, and I think there's the evidence for prehistoric war in here is not overwhelming to me, but I think it's a very, very fascinating read based upon like really the cutting edge research, cross-disciplinary research at this point, because, you know, the whole study of the human mind is just, it's really, to I guess make a sort of pun, mind-boggling what's been accomplished in cognitive science, psychology, anthropology, just all these fields that are sort of blending into each other, and you know, an understanding of our history, and etc. So I just wanted to read a little bit. One of his fundamental points is our capacity for self-deception is fundamental, and then he's going to really expand on that later in the book. I've gotten to this chapter, A Legacy of Lies. Anyway, this sort of carries on from where Buffy St. Marie took us with that song. The discourse of war abounds in doublespeak, contorted language deliberately used to insulate our minds from its hellish reality. During the Vietnam War, bombing missions were, quote, protective reactions, and massive defoliation was a, quote, resources control program. The war itself was, quote, pacification. Mark Twain wrote decades earlier in a Jeremiad against the American invasion of the Philippines, quote, we have pacified some thousands of the islanders and buried them, destroyed their fields, burned their village, and subjugated the remaining millions by benevolent assimilation, which is the pious new name for the musket. Of course, that's the nature of the whole colonization, which, you know, went first under the justification that they weren't either, the indigenous people weren't human, they were less than human, they weren't Christian, whatever. And then, you know, kill the Indian, save the man, the justification for the residential schools in Canada, the Indian boarding schools here, which we're only now starting to talk about investigating their grounds for mass graves, which I'm sure we're going to find innumerable instances of. Anyway, he goes on, the author of The Most Dangerous Animal. In Vietnam, dropping bombs was delivering ordnance, including, quote, soft ordnance or napalm, and the defoliant chemicals that ravaged the landscape were weed killers. Today, we do not kill people. We take them out or neutralize a target, et cetera, et cetera. Kidnapping a person in order to have them tortured is extraordinary rendition. Torture is physical persuasion or debriefing. Assassination is wet work. And it goes on. And then he, you know, the point he's making is basically that Aldous Huxley made, he quotes from, finding the reality of war too unpleasant to contemplate, we create a verbal alternative to that reality, parallel with it, but in quality quite different from it. That which we contemplate thenceforth is not war as it is in fact, but the fiction of war as it exists in our pleasantly falsifying verbiage. That's Aldous Huxley from The Olive Tree. But Smith continues, self-deception lubricates the psychological machinery of slaughter, providing balm for an aching conscience. By pulling the wool over our own eyes and colluding with our own deception, we can continue to think of ourselves as compassionate, moral, and pious people while endorsing or participating in the wholesale destruction of other human beings. To comprehend this in any depth, we need to delve more deeply into the dynamics of self-deception and its antithesis, self-knowledge. Anyway, he goes into a whole kind of a history of how we've looked at self-knowledge and self-deception through Plato and on. And then, his whole thing is based upon cognitive science in that he talks about what the evolutionary purpose of self-deception was and how it sort of worked against us historically, it's been one of the enabling factors of doing war. So, won't get too much more into this, but if anyone out there has also checked out The Most Dangerous Animal, Human Nature and the Origins of War by David Livingston Smith, I think it's well worth checking out. Obviously, the whole issue of kind of fake news, you know, gets into the whole, you know, obviously if people are actually promulgating fake news, whether it's about the climate, whether it's about, you know, the nature of the society we live in, whether it was about what actually happened on January 6th, whether it's about you know, Trump's abuse of women and the denial of that by himself and his followers, whatever it is, that kind of fits into the same framework of you know, you have to have some amount of self-deception if you're promulgating fake news, which, you know, obviously you can say you believe it, but I think, you know, that's a interesting question, which I think he also goes into. How much of it do people actually know that it's not true and continue to say it, and how much do they actually have either convinced themselves or just been convinced through whatever their condition? Anyway, he lays out a very powerful case in this book that the human mind is compartmentalized, first of all. It's not just one mind all working together. These various different modules, kind of specialists, it's really very, as I say, very fascinating. There's kind of different areas of mind that specialize in different things. And so, you know, when you have a compartmentalized mind, you could have some that override other parts of it. Anyway, I'll leave that there. If you want to pick that up, feel free. Certainly, you're welcome to register your ideas and feelings, opinions about the seeming end of a 20-year war in Afghanistan, coming upon the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Talk about that. I did want to kind of explore the connections between the permanent war economy and climate change. I mean, the biggest contributor really to the climate change around the world are the collective armies of the world and all the resources that go into maintaining all the fossil fuels that are used for the production of armaments, the production of all the machinery of war, to keep those machines going, et cetera, et cetera. And we're trapped in this global nightmare of a militarized world of nation states that work against our collective interest by working not just in their own interest, but mostly in the interests of the elites of each nation. And it's just a tragic situation that there doesn't seem to be much way out of. One more thing, as I wait for our first caller, 503-231-8187. Interesting article in Willamette Week this week, Baby Doomers, How to Parent at the End of the World. The environmental nonprofit Families for Climate doubles as a support group for parents and children as they face the grim realities of climate change. Are you a parent or are you a child? How are you thinking about the climate crisis? How are you dealing with it as a parent? It's I can't imagine. I mean, I've got my own existential dread, and I'm 62 going on 63. So, you know, I only have a few decades left. If I had my whole life in front of me and only, you know, to the extent that you know, people have educated themselves about it, but seemingly what we have in future are just more fires, more and bigger storms, sea level rise, flooding after fires, crop failures, mass migrations. Doesn't seem to have much hope of getting much better unless, as everybody says, we act right now. We start now by cutting, you know, 20% of our fossil fuel use every year or whatever. Of course, people have been saying this for decades. Well, let me just read a little bit of that, since it doesn't seem like anybody has gotten the spark to call in and join in the conversation just yet. This is an article by Shannon Gormley in Willamette Week. Whenever Nora Lehman takes her two kids out to Kelly Point Park, she fears environmental disaster. This also gets into some current events here. Current struggles against the fossil fuel industry. Driving to and from the sunny banks of the Columbia River, she passes Zenith Energy's Northwest Portland Terminal and the train tracks it uses to transport crude oil through the city. Zenith recently filed for permits to expand its Portland hub, a move that's faced fierce opposition from environmental groups like Families for Climate, an environmental education and activism nonprofit focused on engaging kids and working around parents' busy schedules. As board co-president and a founding member of Families for Climate, Lehman has helped organize letter writing campaigns to the Portland City Council urging commissioners to block Zenith's expansion. I just heard on OPB, the Think Out Loud program yesterday, they had a Multnomah County council person expressing her explicit opposition. And I believe she said that they passed a resolution basically opposing all such projects of transporting crude oil, especially tar sands oil, through the city. But this is up to the Portland City Council. Anyway, she fears the oil hub could cause an ecological catastrophe, whether it's a massive spill from an earthquake or a train car derailing like the Union Pacific train derailment that ignited a massive oil fire near Moser in 2016, or the Lac Mégantic rail disaster in 2013 that destroyed a small town near Quebec. From an immediate safety perspective, it's really shocking, says Lehman. It's a dereliction of duty by the city council to protect city residents. And on a larger global scale, having this fracked oil being exported and burned, it's an environmental crime. Families for Climate aims to combat not only the transport of fossil fuels, but also the feelings of helplessness and dread that come with raising kids in a world that could be hurtling towards self-destruction. The environmental nonprofit doubles as a support group, both for parents who'd otherwise have little time for activism due to busy schedules, and kids who are growing up at a critical point in the fight against climate change. So this is really interesting. I hadn't actually heard of this group, Families for Climate. So that's something you might want to check out. Again, if you're either a parent or a child, if you're a parent who wants to get your family involved, if you're a child who wants to get your family involved, this might be an interesting place. A couple weeks ago, I hung out with some young folks down at the Portland... Oregon Department of Transportation, down there at Northwest Flanders between, I think, 1st and 2nd or 2nd and 3rd. Anyway, every second Wednesday, so it's probably again this Wednesday, they are down there protesting mainly against the expansion of the I-5 near the Rose Quarter, which is an ongoing thing, which... I'm not sure where they're at actually with the deliberation on that, but it does seem like slowly picking up more opposition. I think one person from the Plan and Sustainability Commission, I think, came out against it. So that's another thing to think about and talk to me about, 503-231-8187. Let me just continue from this climate crisis for the whole family. The environmental nonprofit Families for Climate doubles as a support group for parents and children as they face the grim realities of climate change. Sounds like a good group to have on. Of course, I didn't hear about it until just this morning because it just came out in this morning's Willamette Week. So Nora Lehman and the other founding members realized there was a need for a family focus group in the fall of 2019 after they ran the child care section for the Portland arm of the global climate strike. In Portland, there are plenty of environmental nonprofits, but none that cater specifically to families. Quote, you're so booked as a parent with school, daycare, the commute, shopping, cooking, cleaning, bedtime, bath time, says Lehman, the thought of another meeting where you can't bring your kid and you have to get a babysitter, no one's going to do it. Families for Climate hosted its first meeting shortly after the climate strike at a community center in Northeast. The parents met in one room to discuss their ideas. Childcare was offered in an adjoining room. There was a clear understanding that if someone's kid ran into the meeting room throwing a tantrum, no one was going to roll their eyes. After all, everyone else there was a parent too. Dozens of families showed up, many of whom became emotional during the introductions. Quote, parenting young children in particular can feel really isolating, says Noel Studer-Spevak, Families for Climate's board secretary. This was an opportunity to come out and be with other people. In 2020, Families for Climate became a registered nonprofit immediately after the pandemic hit. perhaps that's why I haven't heard of it yet. It really kind of came of age in the pandemic. The coronavirus increased feelings of isolation and decreased free time for parents, especially those juggling work from home and their children's online learning schedules. But after a two-month break, Families for Climate's members decide to find a way to fit meetings and activism back into their schedules, et cetera, et cetera. Climate Defender Kids, initially the childcare section during in-person meetings, moved online too. Now Climate Defender Kids offers monthly environmental Zoom learning sessions geared to ages 5 to 12. Past topics have included the respiration cycle of trees, how to grow plants, and music as a form of activism. Anyway, this sounds super cool. Definitely one place to plug in for those of you, especially those who are parents, who may not have been able to plug in. Of course, there are lots of other environmental groups working on the climate here in Portland. There's 350.org, PDX. There is Extinction Rebellion. There is the, as I mentioned, the Sunrise Movement, which is going against the freeway expansion, I-5 freeway expansion. And lots of places to plug in. I have kind of somewhat railed against the general lack of urgency and incisiveness. But of course, what am I doing amongst the established groups that... just given the pace of the change that I think more and more people are getting clued into as more and more forests burn and more and bigger storms. Anyway, I was also watching The Day After Tomorrow the other day. Remember that film from a few years ago? What it's talking about. The premise of the movie is actually possibly coming true before our eyes. The possibility that the Gulf Stream current that flows in the Atlantic from west to east and flows by the UK, the islands there. And it is actually, it's been known for quite a while that it has in the past stopped. It's been, I guess, either conjectured or known. And that that there is a great increase in fresh water that's flowing into the Atlantic from, I don't know if it's both from south and north. I haven't fully educated myself, but there's, the idea is that, and from the Greenland ice sheet, that there's so much fresh water that it's, that the salt water, I guess, heats up differently and acts differently than fresh water. And so the vast amounts of fresh water that are being released are actually destabilizing the Gulf Stream. And if that actually breaks down, like the jet stream above is acting really weird. I'm not sure you'd say breaking down. It seems to be breaking apart and causing havoc all over the globe, which is partly what's responsible for at the same time, all these disasters happening at the same time, just so dramatic all around the world. And so anyway, the premise of the film is that it creates these vast superstorms that basically create a mini ice age in various parts of the world. It seems like it's really widespread in the film. My impression was it's the British Isles and then some of parts of Western Northern Europe that would be most affected. But anyway, the film is a really dramatic representation that climate change can happen super fast, and that seemingly historically it has actually happened, instead of over years, like possibly even months or even weeks, once certain tipping points are surpassed. So whether the idea that it's actually going to happen like that movie seems to me far-fetched. I don't know. I haven't actually talked or read experts discuss that the actual, you know, the scientific, if there's a scientific basis for what happens in that movie. But I think the idea that thing can happen really, really fast is occurring to more and more people. It, you know, runaway climate change is the worst case scenario, that actually we pass all the tipping points and that it just starts to spiral out of control. And, you know, it has been 20 degrees hotter than it is now, when there are apparently, I guess, alligators at the North Pole. So these things can happen. And people have said for quite some time, sort of either the cutting edge or the lunatic fringe, however you look at it, of the scientific establishment have actually put forward that as the worst case scenario that we're actually heading towards. And so, yeah, better act fast and better act big. So it looks like we got our first caller on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Paul. Regarding the Zenith fuel storage facility and the possible consequences of earthquake, one of the county commissioners cited that somewhere between 94 and 194 million gallons of fuel stored there could be released into the rivers, into the air, and combusted, burned, basically explosively. And because of the disruption to bridges, getting crews to deal with it would be basically impossible because of the bridges being out. And if that isn't sobering and a reason to get that thing out of there, I don't know.
So just a quick question. So is that range, 94 to 194, is that based upon us just actually not knowing how much fuel is stored, or just there's a possibility of different amounts depending on what exactly happens?
I assume, I don't know the specific answer. I would think that would be dependent on how much is stored there and how much damage occurs.
Right, right. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Right. But, you know, when you think about 100, even 94 million gallons of fuel spilled into the river and burning.
Right. The difference does seem somewhat academic. It's true.
Right. You know, that's that puts catastrophe in capital letters.
No, I haven't been as tuned into that. I guess one starts to almost foolishly assume or think that, oh, we're going to win this one too, because we've won so many. But that's not how victories are won. They're won by continual, persistent, hard fighting. And so, yeah, no, I noticed that there's some people a couple weeks ago, I think it was Extinction Rebellion, were on the tracks doing an action there. And does seem like things are amping up. And so this might be a good time for more people to get involved, because just that whole tank farm there, you know, along the Columbia River is just frightening. And there's just the possibility of, I guess it's the Willamette River, actually.
Right.
I guess Zenith is because they want to expand, so there's a possibility of influencing it. Whereas, you know, actually tackling the tank farm, the existing tank farms, and you know, I heard on OPB yesterday they're talking about, you know, getting underneath and stabilizing, because there's, you know, the possibility of liquefaction in an earthquake, and that's I guess one of the big things. And not a good idea to put massive amounts of volatile fossil fuels right by a major waterway of course they didn't know it was on a liquefaction zone in the case of a major earthquake. But yeah, thanks for calling in with that.
At some point in time, human rights may have to take precedence over corporate rights.
You'd think, wouldn't you?
I would hope. Thanks, Paul.
All right, thanks for calling in. Appreciate that. Yeah, Zenith, that's a big one. Who's up next? Looks like we got Dave right on deck, and then someone coming up after that. Got the full board lighting up. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, Paul.
Hello.
I was reading, I'm going to show my age a little. I was reading a series of books back in the 60s by an English professor. I believe he was at John Hopkins, but it may have been University of Maryland. But he wrote a series of books that were called It All Started With, but the one I wanted to reference was the one he called It All Started With Stones and Clubs, A Brief History of War. He tended to write tongue-in-cheek, but he made the astute observation in that book, in the introduction to it, that the definition of civilization is the ability to kill more people more cleanly with less effort.
Cleanly is an interesting word to use. Cleanly, I guess, meaning...
In other words, if you compare it against slashing people with swords, blowing them up with atomic bombs is
a
whole different level.
Cleanly is like you're looking at it from the wrong end of a telescope and you don't actually have to see it or experience it. That's actually what he talks a lot about in this book, The Human Nature and the Origins of War. He has a really fascinating section. I'll let you continue but he has a fascinating part about just the way we talk about war on films, our TV and whatever coverage it almost never actually depicts war as it actually is, which is just absolutely brutal, you know, intestines all over the place and just a horror show, and it's never depicted. So people are able to maintain this self-deceptive fiction in our brains that it's not as bad, that it's clean, as you said.
Yeah, well, it's never clean, and I think that was the whole point he was making. It's not really clean, and I'm not sure he used the word clean more as an idea of efficiently.
Right, right. No, I got that, yeah.
Anyway, I just thought you'd find that interesting.
And what was that author's name again?
Richard Armour.
Okay, thanks.
A-R-R.
Okay, yeah, he's probably cited in this book. He's pretty thorough. Right on. Well, thanks.
But it was intended to be tongue-in-cheek, but at the same time, he was making some really solid points.
Uh-huh. Right on. Okay, A Brief History of War.
It all started with Stones and Clubs.
It did. And then...
That's the title, and then the subtitle is A Brief History of War.
Okay. Huh, I'll have to look that up. Thanks very much. Appreciate that. Yeah, he also talks about how, in the book, how war as a subject of, like, sociology or psychology was just, like, dismally absent. I mean, like, the most important, almost, you know, what more important subject, really? If you look at it, if you look at human history, is there for studying? It's just been dismally not studied, which again goes into our willful blindness. Okay, so let's go to Elliot, who's up next. Oh, are you still there, Elliot? Do we lose Elliot? Please call back. Looks like we got another caller though. Who do we got up? Oh, been given the finger to wait for a second from my trusty engineer, who now has her hands. We have Elliot. Go ahead, Elliot.
Yes, I know some things about the evolutionary psychology of war, especially the work of Richard Wrangham at Harvard, and I'd like to make a technical comment about its validation. But first, let me just say, Paul, that you're my source for everything Buffy St. Marie. And I would say that the only great war or environment protest songs by Bob Dylan of the last 30 years have all been by Buffy St. Marie.
Yeah, she nails it. She's got a song for just about every subject. Anyway, go on about evolution.
Anyway, a lot of people regard the greatest philosopher America ever produced. It was a guy named Charles Sanders Peirce, who said that, you know, you couldn't completely evaluate any individual hypothesis of a scientific theory just by trying to falsify it, that you had to look at the pragmatic utility of a whole complex theory and see how useful it was to make sure it was correct. Now, there's potential in evolutionary psychology and Rangam saying things like, well, you know, there was a selective advantage to males forming coalitions and engaging in some kind of sexual raiding. But if it was deeply and profoundly true, then in the situations we faced in the last several decades, like in Afghanistan or for that matter in Syria, if it could be used to kind of extremely cleverly on the international diplomatic stage manipulate the levers of human instincts and fixed behavioral patterns, then you could use it to control and moderate war. And no one, it seems, has yet succeeded in using any cognitive anthropological knowledge to, you know, effectively get a handle on trying to, you know, redirect bad situations.
Well, nothing has really
throughout the world.
What's that?
That's also true, I think, of financial corruption throughout the world. I mean,
right, but then you know,
the problem is the pervasiveness of corruption.
Well, yeah, you could say that about any attempt to bring it all under control. There's been relatively little success in curbing war, because anyway, where he goes with this argument, as I said, I probably shouldn't have really started without knowing the full, you know. Basically, I think what he's saying is once we know that that's one of the potentials, but not the only potential, then we can take corrective action. You know, there's lots of ways in which, you know, we trick ourselves or we develop alternative habits or patterns to stop engaging in self-destructive or destructive behavior. There's lots of different ways we do that as individuals, as families, whatever. And I guess he's saying that, you know, it was just one more thing that can help us in understanding that we really do have this potentiality and actually where it comes from. And, you know, obviously,
yeah, and it's multifold. You're saying, yeah, you know, that he's saying that it's, you know, it's multifold or manifold. It's not, you know, one simple dimension. But if it's deeply and profoundly true as a scientific theory, like the theory of relativity, then just as the theory of relativity is controlling our GPS satellites today, the State Department, at least the more enlightened aspects of it, you know, should be able to use it to craft better policies. And there isn't any evidence that, you know, we have any better policy than bombing
right.
the
but
crap
they're
out
not
of.
they're not operating on the knowledge that he's, you know, if
the knowledge was, I mean, you know,
right, but it's not like you have to
pay a lot of consultants,
right, but you can make a lot of money off the knowledge that comes from the physical theories. You can actually monetize them in various technologies and stuff, but you can't monetize this knowledge in the same way. I think that's like one basic fact, that the way we're captured by a corporate capitalist system means that the ability to monetize scientific knowledge takes precedent over, you know, say its ability to actually curb our tendencies, which are exactly the tendencies which allow for such vast profits by the Raytheons of the world. I guess, you know, I think I kind of hear what you're saying, but if I understand it, I think that it doesn't work that way. That our understanding of psychology is usually used by advertisers more than by people trying to like stop bad things from happening.
I agree. I mean, I know exactly what you're saying, but I'm saying as a kind of further on that, you know, in order to evaluate whether the, you know, evolutionary theories make sense, if it, you know, can be applied in the long run, it's, you know, more likely that the theory as a whole, as opposed to very molecular, small hypotheses within the theory, you know, will be proved to be true.
Okay. Well, it's a stimulating subject, and it's good that it sparked you and hopefully some other people to maybe think more. I mean, I think it's a subject, again, the subject of like how war developed. I mean, the whole idea, I guess, in some ways, what you're pointing to is like, okay, how much does actually understanding history, understanding ourselves, understanding how much does that actually contribute to, well, it only contributes insofar as you actually, you know, this is basically in the arena of like social struggle. So, you know, the understanding that racial classifications were fictive, that there is no superior master race, that, you know, white supremacy is actually a myth at root, you know, that those kind of things, you know, the pushback against, you know, eugenics and those sort of ideas that came out under colonialism, you know, that contributed towards a milieu which kind of pushed a civil rights agenda. So yeah, I mean, I think it does that advances in understanding, especially, you know, that aid, you know, marginalized groups. You know, the idea of, you know, various ideas of male superiority, of issues of gender, and those, you know, I think it does contribute towards, but you have to actually engage in the kind of social struggle, because, you know, obviously the dominant classes aren't going to do it on their own. I think that's like the number one lesson.
Well, anyway, I actually knew Steven Pinker. I mean, Steven Pinker, you know, his recent controversy, I mean, he applied evolutionary psychology, claiming that that war and violence actually has gone down a lot in the last 400 years.
Well, I think it's because his framework is flawed fundamentally. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. I've given you a lot of time, and
sure.
Thank you for calling in. I guess I also kind of want to cut this off just because it's getting a little super technical, and we're sort of dropping a lot of names. But I think these are really important. Steven Pinker is like a kind of an intellectual superstar that has gotten a lot of airtime. I haven't read him as assiduously as perhaps I should. He kind of comes off as this sort of Pollyannish that everything's getting better, and I think it's not true. I think that our potential mass society and mass centralized, highly technologically sophisticated with massive weaponry has just created the potential for more disasters and has given us the climate crisis. There's no precedent for the climate crisis. How does Steven Pinker, he assumes that somehow all this great knowledge and technology is gonna save us from what we've created, which is, I think, a total illusion. Anyway, we could go off on that. I really did like this article I read from Baby Doomers, How to Parent at the End of the World. I was kind of hoping to get some parents to talk about that. But we did have someone talk about Zenith, which is, I think, one of the big issues in terms of continuing the good fight against climate disaster and fossil fuel disasters. Looks like we might have another caller. Nope, we don't. 503-231-8187. I thought we did, which is another reason why I had the previous caller let go. But that's okay. We've got, you know, about 5-6 minutes left. 503-231-8187. I've, you know, been talking as usual about the climate. Oh, been talking, wading into the somewhat controversial subject of evolutionary psychology. I know it kind of goes against some sort of strong intellectual trends of, I guess, like sort of postmodernist thought. But I think a dialogue between the sort of the kind of the cutting edge of how science has sort of the unified idea of science between the natural sciences and the quote social sciences, you know, psychology, anthropology, etc. The idea that there can be a unified science which sort of gets beyond the ancient body-mind dualist dichotomy, which is goes all the way back to Plato and probably before, and continues to play itself out in various ways. You know, this is a very very materialist viewpoint, which basically says that, you know, it's all based upon the way our brains work. You know, that our minds are essentially our brains. That looks like all of a sudden we got a couple more callers, so I better just shut up and see who. Mark, go ahead. You are on the air.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for taking my call. Have you heard of the Great Green Wall in China? It began in 1978, and by 2050, it will cover more than 42% of China's landmass. And every citizen above age 11 is required to plant 3 trees every year. This is the largest human-made forest in the world.
Unfortunately, they continue to put out vast amounts of CO2 and other gases because of their huge. I'm not sure it's a great idea. I don't know that. I have heard about it. I don't know, you know, how it's playing out in practice and whether it's actually made any serious dent in their carbon emissions.
Well, they've reached their goal of 20% forest cover by 2010. I just am suggesting it. I think it's very important. An incredible possibility, and the way that we should be going.
Well, my main issue.
If anyone talks about our economy as being healthful, you should point out that $7 trillion was created by the Federal Reserve, you know, to bail out the banks and the GM and everyone else, and that represents more than a third of our whole GDP.
Right. Well, my point is that we need to stop the vast amounts of the industrial economy that are creating the situation, and redirect it to other things like planting trees. But I think my only issue, and I got to let you go because we have another caller, is that the idea that we can continue this vast amount of industrial production and sort of mitigate it by, you know, green technologies and planting trees, I think is illusory. I think planting trees is great. Anyway, let's go to our last caller. Lynn, go ahead. You're on the air. Hello?
Hi. Yeah, I just had to get you off speaker. Yeah, I just want to say that this book, it sounds to me, I mean, of course, I haven't read it either. I guess you're about halfway through it. But it seems to me that means that having a totally peaceful human race is not a given.
Well, totally peaceful, yeah, I think that could be an illusion. Yeah, I think
okay.
Conflict.
Well, elimination yeah. of war.
Okay. Okay.
That says that basically what it's saying is there never was a time when human beings were all peaceful. Well, you know, that utopia never existed.
Well, yeah, because conflict exists, yeah.
Okay. Now, if something never existed, maybe it's possible, but maybe it isn't. You don't really know for sure. What we do know for sure is that up until, you know, what's been happening recently with the climate, we did have a planet with a functioning ecosystem, okay? But we may very well not have that very soon. And if we lose that, you know, this project of peace and all the other projects that are going to take, you know, a lot of time, guess what? There won't be the time to do it. So it seems to me that's an argument for prioritizing social action on climate, you know, ahead of everything else.
Well, you've just opened up a discussion that I've kind of touched on a lot over the years and is a very important one, but you happen to have done it at the top of the hour, and so we're not going to be able to explore that too much. I agree, but with a bunch of caveats. Let's just leave it at that.
I think it might be a good topic for a Wednesday.
Okay.
What do you think?
I will definitely, as I said, I have taken that up in various ways, and I will continue to. But we are flush out of time. So thank you for calling. Thank you, everyone else, for calling. It's been an interesting discussion. And I'll talk with you again next week. This is Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio. Support KBOO.
as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations